Welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with MotoGP here on the Overtime Media Network. Joining you today, as always, is Mr. Mark Daly and Mr. Mark Hamilton. Today, we are going to dive into the meaty topics of the MotoGP preseason. How is Valentino Rossi going to do with his new team? How is Mark Marquez going to look coming back after a major injury? Now, I realize I probably made this long-winded joke before, and I'm starting to go a little bit red. But that said, welcome to the podcast. You know, we are now 7, 8, 9 days away from the first race of the season. We're just hours away from Netflix dropping Drive to Survive Season 3, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And we are fresh out of winter testing. And we've got a ton of material to cover there. But, you know, it's crazy. Like, the more I kind of lean into this season, the more I realize that we're entering a whole new world. And in so many ways, 2021 is kind of a bridge year, right? Like, we were fully anticipating that 2021 was going to be the new F1. It was going to be Formula One V2.0, new bodies, massive parity, the incredibly tough, hard cost cap. But that didn't happen. And it didn't happen because COVID happened and Formula One and Liberty decided, let's push that off for a year, give you guys a year to get some breathing space from a financial perspective, and we'll launch the new regulations next year. But what we've seen this year is we're starting to introduce a lot of those changes. And I want to talk about that a little bit before we get started here. But before we do, you know what? Take a breather. We're out of winter testing. Your initial thoughts? You excited for the season? Drive to Survive in 3 hours.
Yeah, I mean, talk about a great Friday. I mean, first you get to listen to this podcast when you wake up in the morning, and you could follow it up by binging the entire season 3 of Drive to Survive on Netflix. I know what I'm doing. I mean, it's just like the listener emailed us last week and bravely admitted that he'd binged all the shows that we'd put out since New Year, and that which is completely awesome, of course. But you know, you totally caught me off guard there coming out of left field with that whole MotoGP thing. I'm like, hey, did I miss something in a team meeting here? Was there a rebrand I'm not I wasn't aware of? But yeah, it's great. You know, it was funny. I was thinking about it this afternoon, Mark, when I was going out for my walk after I finished work, and I was just like, I was starting to get really excited. I'm like, it's here. You know, it is literally here now. I mean, it got real all of a sudden because I thought, okay, well, winter testing is gone, and I started looking at the calendar. I'm like, hey, after we do this show and we sit down next week, we're going to be doing our season preview, and we're going to be previewing the first race of the year, which is awesome. And it's just, as long as the off season always feels, when you get to the cusp of the season, like the right before the season starts, it feels like all those preceding months and weeks just evaporate into nothing. It's awesome. You know, there's so many interesting things to talk about right now.
I still have a sheet of paper, like my notes from a podcast that feels like it was last week, 58 days until the first race of the season. Like, where did the last like 51 days go? It's totally bonkers. And, you know, I think I kind of want to set up this podcast a little bit, because I think a lot of the content that we're going to talk about is really reflecting on the outcomes of preseason testing, which was last weekend. It was Friday, it was Saturday, it was Sunday. And I think, kind of to set the stage a little bit, I think it's important to understand, we talked about this a little bit last week, that winter testing was really compounded this year. So in the past, it was historically 8 days. Last year, it got chopped down to 6 days. This year, it's 3 days, which means that teams really have 3 days to do a technical shakedown of their cars before you go into the first race weekend of the year. And again, this is all about reducing cost and creating parity. So what we've seen and what we're going to talk about today is going to be a little bit awkward, because for a lot of these teams, like, they're rolling these cars out. If they have a bad day, if you have a gearbox issue or a battery issue, you lose possibly 33% of your entire winter session. So I think that's important to understand. I think that the next thing that's really important to understand, and I heard this on a podcast earlier today, the Shift F1 podcast, so I'll give them full credit, but they made a really great point. And they were talking about the fact that if you wanted to go and find the 2020 F1 cars, for the most part, they don't exist, because that car has fundamentally been integrated into this year's car. Because the parts carryover is so significant, these teams didn't, for the most part, build any new cars. They simply recycled last year's cars. So the last year's cars, the 2020 cars, are effectively absorbed into these Frankenstein 2021 cars. And it's really important to understand that there are some major suspended components going into this 2021 car. So the suspension's identical, the gearbox is identical, the chassis is identical, the survival cell is identical. And really, with the exception of McLaren that kind of got a waiver because they had to make that power unit switch, these cars are very, very, very similar to what we saw last year. Now, there's also been, and I kind of want to tee this up as well, some fairly significant rule changes. And the primary emphasis around this was F1's looking to decrease downforce. So the Formula One teams, their engineers have done such a great job building these super, super, super slippery cars that they're shredding the Pirelli tires, and that Pirelli's engineers can't keep up with the team engineers that are building cars that are becoming too fast for the tires. So they've done a couple of things. One, to reduce downforce, they've made some significant changes to the floors of the car, which we talked about last week. They've changed the diffuser. They've changed the brake ducts. Now, one of the things that I also learned this week, and I didn't actually know about this, and I think it's really interesting to talk about a little bit, is Formula One has now imposed a sliding scale. So for teams in the off season, the amount of time that they're allowed to spend in the wind tunnel or working through computational fluid dynamic computer simulators, the amount of time they're allocated to use those resources varies based on the performance last year. So for instance, Mercedes won the Constructors' Championship, they won the driver's title, they get a fraction of the time to use those resources that a team like Haas or Williams would, which I thought was really interesting. We're not going to see DAS this year, and I don't know if we're going to touch on this. That was something that Mercedes kind of surprised the world with when they showed up to preseason testing with it last year. And the other big one is that in the past, and last year for examples, teams were allowed to bring upgraded power units throughout the season. So you know what? Last year, they were allowed to bring two new power units, which means, hey, we bring a power unit to the winter testing, we can bring a new one a couple months later, and then we can introduce another one later. So the teams were allowed to iterate on the power units coming into this season, but the minute we hit Bahrain, that power unit is frozen, and they can make no further changes to it until the end of the season. So if they show up with a crappy power unit, you're stuck for the year. There's no iterating, there's no changes. So for a team like Ferrari, it means they better have gotten that recipe right very beginning.
Yeah.
So I kind of wanted to set the table for what we're going to talk about, because I think a lot of this is kind of foundational and good knowledge for the conversation that we're going to have today.
Yeah. Well, you know, there were a couple of things that really stood out from winter testing. Number one was like the changes to the floor. And the one thing I found really, really interesting was the fact that Mercedes has gone with like this ripple floor along the edges, because, you know, they've made these changes, and now they've done other things by putting like these fins at the back, some of the teams, to try and direct the airflow around the rear tires and things like that. And then you got McLaren that it's going to come up with this radical diffuser design. It's really quite interesting, because usually I don't obsess on these little details too much, but this year I find it really interesting, because like you say, we've got these Frankenstein sort of hybrid cars that are sort of bridging this year till next year, when it's going to be, you know, completely new Formula One, right?
Totally.
And that notwithstanding, I find it interesting where you see some of the teams have decided to spend their tokens. McLaren obviously had to spend their tokens heavily on the fact that now they have a Mercedes power unit going into a car that was designed to hold a Renault engine. So that was one of them. You see AlphaTauri, for example, that have invested heavily in redesigning the nose on that car, among other things. And it's really cool to see the cars completely unveiled, because when we had the releases 2 weeks ago, and over the past several weeks, actually, you know, you get these the cars that are, you know, strategically photographed, or, you know, their parts totally are hidden, and they unveil it. I mean, Mercedes kind of surprised a lot of people showing up to Bahrain with this ripple floor. And now it turns out that this car has an extremely unstable rear end. So now the question is, you know, can they fix it? And is this floor the problem? I mean, they've been saying themselves that there's no easy fix to it, but let's, before we kind of dive into it any further, let's just run down some of the fastest lap times. So the fastest time of the entire test was Max Verstappen, who set the fastest time of 128.96. Then this is really, I think, the standout is Yuki Tsunoda and the AlphaTauri, the sister Red Bull team. And he set a fastest time of 129.053, so less than a tenth of a second off Max's fastest time. That was really impressive. Then you have Carlos Sainz, Kimi Raikkonen, Lewis Hamilton, George Russell setting a time of 130.117. So he's about 1.15 seconds off Max's fastest time. Danny Ricciardo, Sergio Perez, Fernando Alonso. I'm going to have to get used to talking about Fernando back in Formula One. And then Charles Leclerc rounding out the top 10. I mean, Charles, his time was a 130.486. And, you know, he's a second and a half, off the pace of Max Verstappen. But, I mean, Sergio Perez, I mean, he's 1.2 seconds off of his teammate. And he ran only 49 laps compared to 65 for Max. So, I don't know. What is your takeaway from some of the lap times there? Out of those top 10 finishers or those top 10 fastest lap times, which are the ones that stand out for you?
You know, I'm super glad you asked this question. And for me, you know, and I think you and I talked a little bit about this on WhatsApp. I think you want to be careful, especially in Bahrain, not to read a lot into these lap times. And I think it's important to understand a couple of things. One, the Friday sessions were pretty much a write-off. I don't know if our listeners saw, but there's some fantastic photos. The area got hit with a sandstorm. The conditions were slippery. It was windy the entire time. The track was a disaster. So if you look at the number of laps the teams were putting down, there wasn't a ton on the Friday. But I think some of the analysis that I've seen suggests that due to the impact of humidity at this track at certain times of day, a lap time that you might put in at, say, 9 or 10 in the morning, if you put that exact same time in 4 hours later in the middle of the day when humidity hits its peak, it could be 2.6 or 2.7 seconds slower. So there's a lot of debate about, like, you know what, Max did fantastic. He put in a great time. But the fact is, he just happened to put that lap time in at an optimal time of day versus Sergio Perez, who was putting an equally good pace, but he was just putting them in at a inferior time of day. So for me, I don't want to put a lot of stock into these times. I think for me, the takeaways, one, the Red Bull Honda engine, and I got to start saying Red Bull slash, the Red Bull Honda engine looked fantastic no matter. So aside from all of that noise I just introduced and that friction to the conversation, I think the biggest takeaways for me is the Honda motor looks fantastic. It had a great day on Thursday. It had a great day on Friday, despite the conditions. And it had a great day on day three as well. To me, that looks fantastic. The AlphaTauri, and again, I think there was a lot of criticism on social media, and I think we got to be cautious with that Yuki time, because he was being a little bit liberal with the DRS switch to get that time on day three, and I think some of his fellow racers had commented on that as well. But for me, you know what, I'm cautiously optimistic for Red Bull Honda, but I don't want to take a lot from these times, to be honest, simply because the conditions weren't optimal, the track was very slippery, there was high wind all 3 days, and the Friday session was pretty much washed out because of a sandstorm. So I'm being cautious. So I'm not reading a lot into this. I think for me, and I know we'll get into this, I think the more compelling stat is the total number of laps that the teams were putting in, because that speaks to reliability. And if you look at this race weekend, if you look at the teams, and I know we'll get there, most laps completed by team, Alfa Romeo at 422, Aston Martin at 314, and Mercedes 304.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's pretty impressive too. I mean, if you look at some of the individual drivers, Kimi Raikkonen comes out on top with 166 laps, 158 for George Russell. And then you go down, look at the list. I mean, Lewis Hamilton, only 54 laps, out in testing over the course of those couple of days. Valtteri Bottas, a little bit more, 86. Sebastian Vettel, 56 in the Aston Martin. And you look at Sergio Perez, only, he didn't even break, a half century, only had 49 laps. So it really is interesting. I think you bring up a really great point, Mark, just the fact that they're running at different times, they're running in different scenarios. There's the whole question about who's sandbagging and who's all these different questions. So. I mean, I always harken back to, what was it, 2018, I think it was, or is it 20? Maybe it was 2019 when Ferrari came out, and they were like, everybody saying, oh, they're a second and a half faster than the Mercedes, and it was all just it was just all smoke and mirrors, really. I mean, by the time we got to Australia several weeks later, it just did not live up to reality. But I mean, that's notwithstanding, and we'll get into this in a moment because we're just coming up on a break here. But I mean, I think Red Bull have to be pretty positive about what they achieved over the past, the past week. And I'm not just saying that because I'm decked out in the Red Bull team wear tonight. But that's part of it. But I mean, they do have a reason to be very, very positive. I mean, we're hearing things from Mercedes struggling with this rear end on the car. And it's funny. It's just just the language you just don't expect to hear from coming from Mercedes. I mean, it seems like Mercedes and Red Bull have almost switched bodies over the past week. You know, it just it's a bit of a bizarre scenario at the moment.
I have a ton to add to that, but we should probably jump to a break so sure. I don't derail the show like usual.
It's all good. Anyways, let's do just that. We're going to take a quick break here on the Overtime Media Network, so don't go away. We'll be back in just one moment. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time, or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, is he declaring an emergency? There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, well, welcome back to the podcast. As always, up to speed with Formula One here on the Overtime Media Network, coming to you in podcast and also on YouTube to welcome to all our listeners and viewers this week. So, Mark, going back to winter testing, which we talked about in the first segment of the show here, and I think we really need to just discuss the situation a little bit further between Mercedes and Red Bull because, you know, as I said just before the break, Mercedes obviously struggling with the rear end on that car. They're saying that there's no easy fix to it, and it's almost a little bit of sort of fatalistic and, I don't want to say defeatist kind of tone, but just not the sort of language you hear from Mercedes. You have Bottas saying, well, they had a decent recovery. It was a decent test and things like that. And then you have Marco, on the other hand, at Red Bull saying, this is the best test that we've ever had since Red Bull's ever existed. And, you know, it's completely the opposite sort of tone that you're hearing from both of them. And I find it fascinating. I mean, you obviously can't count Mercedes out because we've seen them, you know, hit some snags over the years, and then they go back and they double down. They come back 2 weeks later at the next race, and it's like nothing ever happened, and they're better than they were before. So, I mean, they're going to figure it out. The question is, can they figure it out quick? And when they do figure it out, how are they going to match up against Red Bull? I mean, the litmus test, of course, is going to be in a week's time when we get to the first race, but there's an awful lot of question marks out there heading into the opener.
I completely agree. I got to share something that one of my close friends had messaged me on WhatsApp a couple of days ago. And he'd made this comment about the fact that he's like, I'm so sick of how humble F1 teams are when they're being interviewed during winter testing. It's like, you know, you go up to a driver on a team's like, well, you know, we're trying, but this team looks amazing and that team's awesome and their pace is fantastic. It was really interesting because you kind of speak to that with Red Bull, which is Helmut Marko was like, hey, this is just flat out the best winter testing we've ever had. And it's relatively unusual for a Formula One team to demonstrate that degree of confidence because the season starts so quickly and things can turn on you so quickly that quote can kind of just sit there for the rest of the season as your performance deteriorates weekend over weekend over weekend. So I thought it was super interesting that he was willing to make a comment like that. But it also speaks to the fact that I think they've done some really important foundational things. And I think they've done some really important technical things. And Honda themselves have been pretty open about some of the changes that they made to the power unit. So the power unit that Honda brought to Red Bull, to Milton Keynes during the offseason, is almost a completely new build. It's an all new power unit. It's smaller, it's lighter, it's got improved thermal efficiency, it's far more compact, and it sits lower in the car, which provides a lower center of gravity. So Honda is ecstatic about the power unit. Honda themselves, kind of speaking to the level of confidence coming out of the Red Bull family right now, they believe that the Honda power unit that they showed up to winter testing with produces more power than the Mercedes power unit that won the constructors and the drivers titles last year. They are full of confidence. So from a technical perspective, I think they're in a really good place. They've obviously made some significant changes to the suspension, which we talked about, but foundationally, and I think this is the reason they're probably so confident, is Perez looked fantastic. Sergio looked fantastic. And again, if you look at the time sheet, he's a couple of seconds off of Max. But ultimately, I think a lot of that just goes back to the fact that he was running at a less optimal time of day. And when you reverse engineer the lap times, and if you reverse engineer the G's he was pulling in the corners, the times are pretty comparable. In fact, it's conceivable that if they were running together, he may have been outpacing Max a little bit. So I think the team is ecstatic. And I think they feel very, very confident that the package they've brought and the driver lineup could help deliver them a Constructors' Championship. And you know, you look at the last couple of years, that was never going to happen. You can't win a Constructors' when you have a driver consistently on the podium and the other driver in 6-7-8, 6-7-8, 6-7-8. Like, I think they have all the reason in the world to be confident. And to your point about the Mercedes thing, you know, we've seen this before. 2019, Ferrari comes in. They're laying crazy lap times. Mercedes looks a little bit slow. But I think the main takeaway for me this weekend was the body language of Bottas and Hamilton. Like, you made that fantastic comment about defeatist. Like, it's one thing to read a quote and say, hey, look, we've got lots of work to do. Red Bull looks really good. But when you saw the video interviews, they looked defeated, man. And that was my biggest takeaway from the Mercedes camp. And I still have supreme confidence, but I was shocked to see that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not something that we're used to seeing. I mean, we like I was saying just now that we've seen these certain instances over the years. I mean, Monaco, what was a couple of years ago, was one where it was just an awful weekend, and they just went back to the factory. They doubled down for that 2 weeks, and they came back to Montreal, and they were better than ever, right? So it's just a really interesting, because you have James Vowles. He's talking about they have no idea what's causing with this the instability right in the rear end, and you know, like I said, Bottas was saying, yeah, it was a decent recovery or a decent testing session. I mean, decent just does not really, you know, that's not really a word. Yeah. I mean, when it comes to Mercedes, decent is just not good enough. I mean, they are the gold standard. I mean, they have constantly reset the bar higher and higher and higher each and every year since 2014. So decent just doesn't cut it for these guys. And then, but just more to your point, what you're just talking about with, you know, Sergio looking good, Max looking good, the Red Bull looking good, and the Honda, you know, engine looking extremely strong. You have Lewis saying that that the Red Bull is going to be a different animal this year. I think that Mercedes, for the first time, is legitimately feeling some heat. I mean, I think they felt some heat a couple of years ago, especially in the first half of 2018. But I think that was more during over the course of the season, once the season got going, and Seb's racking up some wins here and there, and he was legitimately pushing Lewis through the first, yeah, two-thirds of the season, definitely until Monza. And then after that, the wheels fell off the whole title challenge there. But I mean, I think that, you know, due to the fact that Red Bull looks so strong in testing and they're struggling a little bit right now, I think that they're legit nervous going into the season next week. And I think
they should be.
Yeah, they should be. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that if you're, you know, you're a fan going into the season, you don't cheer for, you know, well, obviously if you're not cheering for Mercedes, but I think just almost from a neutral point of view, you know, from Formula One's point of view, it's setting up to be a cracking opener in the desert next weekend. I just can't wait. It's going to be great. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, I can't really agree with you anymore. And I think what I'm struggling to wrap my head around is, for the most part, these cars are a carryover from last year. Like, what did they do at the Mercedes factory to bring such an, and you know, I'm going to quote both Lewis and Valtteri here. The car has balance issues. It has handling issues. The rear end is a diva. And you know, and here's an interesting point as well. In 3 days of testing, Hamilton spun twice.
Yeah.
Hamilton doesn't spin. Like, I can't reconcile myself with what they did in the off season to bring this package. Like, the power unit's going to be good. It's the handling and the balance issue that to me is a little bit alarming. And you know what? I think oftentimes when a car shows up and it looks slow, but it's reliable and it's sticky and it stays on track, that's one thing, because oftentimes they just turn up that power unit by the time they get to the first race.
Mm-hmm.
Power doesn't seem to be the issue. It seems to be, to your point, handling and balance and everything else associated with keeping that car on the track.
Well, you know what really fascinates me about this whole thing is that, as you so rightly pointed out at the top of the show, that these cars are basically a carryover from last year. So, I mean, this is just a development on the W11.
Yes.
And the W11, they said, this is the best car that we've ever built. So, you know, that's what strikes me as even more, you know, more bizarre about the whole thing, that, you know, if this is just a development on this car that was supposedly the best one you ever built, why all of a sudden are you having just these fundamental issues? It really does not compute.
Yeah, I completely agree. But to your point, I think, and we talked about this last week, the best possible thing for the support or for the sport is to have a competitive championship this year. And again, we'll talk about our predictions next week. I think Lewis is still in a great position,
yeah.
But I think Red Bull's got to be like, you know, maybe we don't have a shot at the driver's title, but maybe the constructor's title is wide open. And what this is telling us is that if the championship is as competitive as we hope and maybe think it's going to be, I think the pressure that's going to pile up on Lewis this year and on Valtteri is going to be obscene. And we already expect that, right? Like, we talked about how Hamilton's contract situation is going to be a distraction,
mm-hmm.
but all of a sudden the pressure could be monumental. And it's really, except for kind of a brief period in 2018 and a brief period in 2019, the first time this team will have felt significant pressure since, well, really ever.
Ever,
and
yeah.
The V8 hybrid, they had no expectations. So this might be the first time.
Yeah, and that really is another thing too. I mean, there's obviously, like you say, going to be those distractions with Hamilton's contract status. But, you know, if they can't perform to their own standards, and you know they're not winning races and they're behind in the championships, I mean, talk about a field day for the media and the speculation and all the questions that are going to be asked of this team. It really is, you know, it is quite unexpected. And I was just looking through some of my notes here, and I thought it was interesting here. You have the trackside engineering director of Mercedes, Andrew Shovlin, pardon me, who said that at the end of testing after the 3 days, that their team's actual own data proves that they are behind Red Bull on pace. And I'll just read what Shovlin had to say, because I think it's quite interesting. So he says, quote, "We made a bit of progress with the balance on the higher fuel and the car was more predictable, but we can see from the data we've collected over the last few days that on race pace, we're not as quick as Red Bull. The lower fuel work was a more confusing picture. We didn't gain enough and we need to go and look at our approach, as far too many cars were ahead of us on pace today. We had issues in recent years with pace and winter testing and managed to make good progress before the first race, but we may have our work cut out this time. We've not got long before we're back here for the race, so we've planned a program to try and work out and understand some of our issues, and we'll be leaving no stone unturned in our efforts to find some more speed over the next 10 days, end quote. So does, you know, just reading between the lines there, there's going to be some, obviously some serious overtime going on at the Mercedes factory to try and figure that out. But it really is bizarre. I mean, I don't think that, you know, I don't doubt for a second they'll get it, figured out. But, you know, I think it's just, a bit of an indicator now going into the season that we're already seeing the effects of the cost cap, obviously the reduced testing times, that, you know, you just don't have that opportunity. You don't have the benefit of running out there as, oh, yeah, well, we had a bad day today. You know, we've got tomorrow or the day after that or the day after that. Well, no, you don't. You've got 3 days and that's it. And then, you're going to have to go back and try and figure it out on the computer, or else you're going to have to figure it out when you get back to the first race of the season. And it just, really adds another variable into the proceedings, and it could really shake things up. I mean, of course, this has to be proven in the real world, but this whole cost cap thing, and it might just prove that to be the great equalizer, because you just can't kind of spend your way and test your way out of issues now. You got to pretty much figure it out on the fly.
You know, that's such a great point, right? Is this could be, and I'd never made that, even though I talked about the cost cap right off the top, I never made that connection in my head that what we're seeing with Mercedes may very much be the cost cap tightening its grip on the sport already. And, you know, we talked about the fact as well that, hey, you know what, Mercedes had the least available time to run wind tunnel testing and CFD testing, computational fluid dynamics modeling in their computers, what we're seeing might be a direct offset of that, that the handling and balance issues could be related to aero that they weren't able to solve because they didn't have the time to do it. And you know, in previous years, Mercedes may have just run a wind tunnel 24 hours a day, and they may have just had their CFD server farms just running 24 hours a day, running every conceivable simulation. But no. You won the championship. You get X time, and we're going to monitor that. And then all of a sudden, they're at a disadvantage because if they have a problem that their engineers need to solve, they don't have the same resources to solve that problem that maybe another team does. So that's an awesome point. And if the cost cap's designed to increase parity, this might be the first sign of that starting to happen, which is really, really exciting. I don't know.
It's definitely interesting. I mean, you would think just the fact that everybody has the same amount of money to play with, but I mean, if you throw in some of these other factors as well, that, you know, because of where you finished up in the championship, limits of what you can and cannot do when it comes to certain areas, you know, the amount of time you have to develop or work on certain areas. Yeah, I mean, every minute literally counts, and if you can't get it done within your allotted time, then, you know, sorry guys, but you know, that's it. You know, try again next week or next month or however they, you know, they sort of dole out these different things. But yeah, it certainly adds a lot of different things, you know, a lot of different factors into it. And I mean, I guess there are more than one ways that you can kind of introduce parity into the sport rather than just what's happening with the cars on the track. And maybe that's what the sport is, you know, maybe really missed, or maybe didn't have the foresight to see in years gone past, is some of these, you know, I hate the term out of the box, but, you know, it is exactly that, the out of the box thinking and approach to, okay, well, what can we do to, you know, promote parity in the team? Like, what can we give the teams that that aren't doing as well? What can we give them in, you know, other advantages if you finish lower down the grid? Because, I mean, if you finish lower down in the grid and, you know, you have teams like Williams that are only, you know, maybe getting a 1 or 2 points in the constructors, and, you know, that's, you know, a massive amount of money that that they're not, you know, taking home in prize money from the Constructors' Championship. So, I mean, they're taking double hits all over the place. So I'm glad to see that they've done, you know, they've thought of other ways. But hey, Mark, let's just take a quick break here, and we'll come back. We'll pick it up in a moment, and we'll keep on going talking about the winner of what we like to call the Winter Championship here on the on the show. So don't go away, guys. We'll be back in just a moment. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And Mark, I had to chuckle a little bit earlier in the previous segment because you were sort of, you didn't come out outright and say it, but you were sort of almost, you know, talking about the fact that basically everybody's a frenemy in Formula One. And I was thinking, you know, that nobody really comes out and says anything. I was just like, God, you know what's missing from Formula One is some good old fashioned North American style trash talk. Go grab some guys from the NFL, the NBA. Well, maybe not hockey. I don't know how good hockey players are trash talk. Just, I don't know, get like 5 or 10 guys in there and just get them to school Formula One drivers and people, you know, get, you know, teach them some trash talk. I think it could liven up the sport a little bit, or maybe not, but you know, they're but like you say, everybody tends to be, you know, tends to agree with each other a little bit too much. And I don't know, maybe you can get the lights of Richard Sherman from the San Francisco 49ers. He's always been fairly outspoken, you know, get some guys like that over that. It would lend a little bit more color to the sport, or maybe I'm completely wrong. Anyway, so where should we take it from here, my friend?
You know what? I would love if we have the opportunity, and I think we've done a really good job of kind of reflecting on the Mercedes performance. And again, I want to be clear that if Mercedes shows up this coming weekend, and they are not this coming weekend, next weekend, and they look dominant, don't be surprised. But I think what we've shown, or we've seen this last weekend, is there might be some cracks, and that cost cap might be tightening its grip a little bit. But I think the one team that I would love to be able to talk about a little bit is McLaren.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I'm just hydrating here. You kind of cut off a little bit before I was ready. Yeah, absolutely. McLaren is one of these teams that I think we obviously should be looking at this year, because I mean the big thing is they've gotten away from the Renault engines. They're going back to partner with Mercedes, which they obviously enjoyed a mega successful period in their in their history when they had that partnership some time ago. But the thing is, they came off a very successful 2020, finished fourth in the championship, and I mean the signs have kind of been there over the previous year, 18 months or so. But last year, I think they were a real revelation. I thought that they really did well. Both Carlos Sainz and Lando Norris maybe didn't really grab the headlines a lot, but from start to finish in what was a bizarre year to begin with in the middle of a pandemic, I think they did really well. But the question is, how are they going to do this year? I mean, like I said, they've got the switch, the new power unit, and it just kind of makes you wonder, how is everybody around them going to compare? I mean, they've kind of come out of out of nowhere. They've really surprised people with this very innovative diffuser that they're running, which they said that they're really surprised that nobody else kind of caught on to, which kind of takes me back more than a decade to the debut of Braun GP and that double floor, whatever they were running back in 2009, yep. Which really caught everybody by surprise. And, you know, there was a lot of questions about the legality about that back then, as there were some questions about this diffuser design that McLaren are having. And, you know, ultimately it was all decided, you know, both cases that everybody realized it was legal. And I like that. You know, I love it when teams are able to come up with designs like this that are completely unexpected. You know, it's really, it's showing a lot of ingenuity, especially in this new era of Formula One, in the cost cap era. You got to be a little bit more creative with what you've got. And they've certainly found a way to make this work. But the big question is, they could have a quicker car than last year, but depending on what everyone else does around them, you know, they may or may not be as successful as they were in 2020.
Absolutely. And the question is going to be this coming season, was 2020 a fluke, right? This was a team that finished third in the constructors. And we've talked so much about the fact that they benefited possibly more than anybody by the Ferrari performance. They benefited by the fact that Aston Martin Racing Point had points taken away from them, that they had some soft performances, that Lance had COVID and had a couple of tough weekends. They benefited by a lot of things. But that said, you can't take away the performance that they did have. My takeaway from their performance this past week was very, very positive. This was a team that put in, I think, about 325, 330 laps. Not a ton by any measure, but I think a lot of that was by design, that they were looking more at the technical and data consumption angle of the weekend as opposed to just putting in a ton of laps for the sake of putting in laps. They also did get some time at Silverstone shortly after they launched the car back in February. So they had a lot of data coming into this weekend. So this weekend wasn't as critical to McLaren as it was a lot of other teams that haven't had a car on the track yet this winter. And I think that one of the bigger questions for them was, you're taking a car that was fundamentally designed 18 months ago for a Renault power unit, and you wedged a Mercedes power unit in it. What is that marriage going to look like? And I think that the answer is, it looked exceptional. The car looked great. It balanced well. The feedback from both Nando and Daniel regarding the performance of the car in the corners, out of corners, how they were able to rotate the rear end, all of the feedback from them about the car was very, very, very positive. Power delivery looked good. I think that ultimately we probably respect the fact that this is still possibly the most powerful power unit on the grid. I guess it's ultimately going to depend on how that Honda unit looks the first weekend in Bahrain. But ultimately, the package looks good. The drivers look good. They were consistent. They didn't make mistakes, and they didn't have any reliability issues. So I think they're in a really good position to be competitive once again. I think the one big question is that the midfield, and I'd seen this quote and I can't remember who said it, but the midfield has now just become the field.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. Like
you have maybe one or two teams at the top. Yeah. One or two teams at the bottom. So you've kind of got Mercedes and Red Bull up here. You've got Haas and Williams down here. And then you've got this group of six teams in the middle, and almost anything can happen. But ultimately, I was really, really impressed with McLaren and the package that they showed up with. They just look organizationally in a really, 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 really great place right now. That Mercedes power unit bolted to that existing chassis, that's an incredible engineering feat. And it's funny because, and we talked about this so many times, we've seen this before, right? Where a Mercedes power unit is bolted to a chassis that was designed for somebody else's engine. We saw that with Braun, and we know how successful that was. But I'm incredibly optimistic for what this season could look like. I'm not suggesting they're going to win races, but I think they're going to have a flurry of podiums throughout the year.
That would be really exciting because we were talking earlier in the show, and quite rightly, about how strong Red Bull came out of the test. I mean, I think you got to have to give an honorable mention or runner up to McLaren because the car looks good, the engine obviously looks good, and I think that they've got an extremely strong driver pairing in Danny Ricciardo and Lando Norris. I mean, Lando, I think, is in a great position. He's coming off two very strong years, starting out in Formula One, partnering up with a guy that's been in Formula One for quite some time. He's won races. He's, Ricciardo's a proven quantity in Formula One. We know what he's all about. And I'm really excited to see what this team can do this year because they really have gone in the right direction over the past couple of years. I mean, this is a fundamentally different team than the Fernando Alonso and what was his name, Boullier, when he was at the team and the Honda engines back in 2015. I mean, they've made changes right at the foundational levels, and they've put such pointed such good people in key areas of this team, and slowly but surely we've seen them really reap the rewards of that. But of course, I mean, like you say now, and I saw that same quote now, it stood out at the time and I can't remember who said it, but it seemed fascinating to me that the midfield is now just a field, and I think that could be extremely exciting to watch. And I think also too, what should be exciting to see and interesting to see is if you have your front runners, which we assume are going to be Mercedes and Red Bull at the moment, how far is that gap going to be to the best of the rest? Or in this case, just the rest, right? And then, of course, I guess the wild card in this one is going to be Ferrari. Where are they going to line up in here? But I think that McLaren really gets a special mention coming out of winter testing. And it certainly is. It's going to be an interesting one to watch because, I mean, they could have a better car and they could potentially not finish as good as they did last year or maybe better. But, I think what you're saying there is that if they do end up with a flurry of podiums this year, I think that would be exciting. It would be great to see them back up there. And I think both of these guys, Norris and Ricciardo, are probably just licking their chops and just ready to jump in that car and fired up when the lights go green next weekend. I think they're ready to go. I think they look great.
The one thing I want to add about McLaren before we move on as well is they've done all of this against a backdrop of financial crisis. The McLaren road car division, the enterprise as a whole has been going through a financial crisis. So the fact that the business has been able to separate the F1 operations team and make sure that it's as Teflon and isolated and insulated as possible from everything else that's going on in the company has been fantastic. And again, the company's hemorrhaged cash. They've had to sell their famous Woking factory and go through a leaseback agreement. They've had to borrow a ton of cash from the Bahraini government. Like, they've had to do some pretty drastic steps to keep liquid through all of this. But ultimately, the fact that they've been able to insulate F1 operations and allow them to continue to build and not stagnate and not suffer as a result of the financial pressures the organization have been feeling is fantastic. So totally agree. They've got the right people in key roles making the right decisions. And I can't wait to see how this turns out during the season.
Yeah, absolutely. It is good to see them getting back to where you expect them to be, because we grew up in an era when they were dominant in the 1980s and the 1990s and the early 2000s. And then it is just, the decline was kind of like long and over a protracted period of time. But, coming into that, the turbo hybrid era, and then, especially, and I don't want to take anything away from Honda. I mean, they just came to the V6 turbo hybrid era later than everyone else. I mean, Mercedes obviously came into it more prepared than everybody else, in 2014. I mean, they were so much ahead of the game than say Ferrari or Renault were at the time. And, they spent a significant time obviously preparing for that as well. I mean, Honda, they came in a little bit later and they started their program later on. But certainly it seemed at the time like the McLaren Honda revival was going to be, a real thing, and obviously turned out to be otherwise. And, let's not forget, in all these, costs issues and financial issues that they face. I mean, when they broke that deal with Honda a couple of years ago, what did it cost them? Was it £100 million, £100 million bucks? I mean, either way you shake it, I mean, that's a heck of a lot of money. I mean, and then you put into it on top of it all the, you know, the cost to run a Formula One program, and then you have a pandemic and an economic crisis on top of it, and all those other things that that you just mentioned. I mean, I'd love to go to that, you know, to their headquarters in Woking. I mean, you say, I mean, it looks like such a fantastic building, but to be able to walk in there, sort of along that that walk of fame, if you want to call it, and all those historical cars they have there. I mean, it just makes me salivate just thinking about that. That's got to be something I got to do at some point one of these days when we're you know, able to travel again and go to some of these places we all want to. But certainly one worth checking out. Now, I want to talk. I just want to get this one rolling right now before we go into our next break in a couple of minutes, Mark. But I think one that really stood out in winter testing was just how much Aston Martin were off the pace. I mean, Lance and Seb were like six and a half, seven seconds off the pace. I mean, you know, this is something that that even you know, Williams haven't sunk to those lows in some of their darker years in recent times. What was your takeaway from Aston Martin over the testing?
Well, thank you for asking. I think my biggest concern is reliability. And you know what? I've made a couple of notes here. They had gearbox issues, they had electrical issues, and they had turbo issues. None of those are good signs. Lance managed to put in considerably more laps. I think he put in about 200 laps in total. I think his teammate, oh my gosh, I think his teammate put in maybe a fraction of that. Vettel was really bitten ultimately by the reliability bug, and he, of all drivers, needed to get some significant time in this car. It's his first time with the car. It's the first time with a Mercedes power unit. He desperately, desperately needed those laps, and he just didn't get them, which is really, really, really unfortunate. But yeah. I think my biggest concern was, despite a couple of flashes from Lance when he hooked up a couple of hot sectors, it didn't look good. And again, I don't want to read a lot into this, but I think coming out of last season, and this team had so much momentum and they had a race victory, this was a really disappointing weekend. And the reliability piece for me is the single biggest concern. That said, you and I haven't talked about Aston. Your thoughts, are you in panic mode? Because I know you and I were both so excited about them, or are you being a little bit more cautious about the performance they put down?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. I was very excited. You know, had a lot of high hopes for this team coming into the year, but I don't want to hit the panic alarm, the panic button just yet. I mean, certainly it was a very disappointing you know, outing for them in Bahrain at that test session. I mean, based on what we've seen, especially last year in their final year's Racing Point, I mean, they went out on a high note, obviously with Sergio winning that race right at the very end of the year. So to see some of these struggles that they have with the AMR21, yeah, it was underwhelming. It was concerning, but you know, you hear some of the some of the quotes from Lance and from Seb that you know, they're not ready to panic just yet. I mean, obviously, it wasn't the ideal start that they wanted, and I just worry whether or not this lack of time is going to really impact them more. I mean, you can work through some of these issues, you can figure them out, but it's just the opportunity that the missed time on the track that I really worry about. Getting that real world data is really going to hurt them, and we'll talk about that in a moment here. We're just going to head into another break, so please hang on, guys. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about Aston Martin in a little bit more detail. All right, well, welcome back to the show, and we're talking winter testing, we're talking Aston Martin and some of the issues that they obviously had. So, you know, one of the quotes that I saw from Lance was, he said that Seb was being, what he said, very wise with his feedback about the car. So my immediate reaction to that was Seb just not wanting to be too overly critical right away, or was it more to the fact that his comments were a lot more accurate, maybe precise about some of the issues? Anyways, Lance had to say, quote, he's very knowledgeable when it comes to the behavior of the car, what he wants from the car, and his comments are just very wise. He has a lot of experience and is a very talented driver, obviously. It's still early days, though. I'm sure I'll get to know him much better in the next few weeks when we start to go racing and when we're on the track at the same time doing similar programs. We'll probably be able to relate to each other's comments and give our feedback and also have a much better idea of what we're both talking about. So I think, it was obviously a really catchy title, but I think that what Lance is talking about is maybe that initial exposure of being around a guy that is as experienced, as knowledgeable, and a proven winner in Sebastian Vettel.
Yeah, I completely agree. And this is something that we've alluded to in the past as well, which is, what was the motivation for Lawrence Stroll to bring Sebastian Vettel to this team? And I think you and I had concluded, or at least I'd kind of rammed this down your throat, which was the concept that Vettel brings a professionalism and an expertise to the sport that maybe Lance hasn't necessarily been exposed to before, and that the presence of Vettel would help the team accelerate their development of the car through really valid technical, tactical feedback based on his experiences driving it, but also that Lance could in turn learn from Vettel. And I think that's maybe what we're already beginning to see, because if you flash back, like you look at 2017, Lance is paired with Felipe Massa. And by all accounts, Massa wasn't happy to be there. He didn't want to be there. He planned to retire at the end of 16. He kind of got looped back into the car because Bottas went to Mercedes. 2018, Lance is paired up with Sergei Sorokin, right? Like another rookie driver. So there was nothing to learn from 2018. And then it's kind of just been a weird mishmash since then. Yeah. I think Perez is a great driver. He's a professional. I don't know that he was necessarily in a position to educate and train and mentor Lance, but I think, and we've talked about this before, it's pretty well understood that Vettel came to this team with the understanding that we need you to help us develop the car. We need you to help us develop our young driver. And yeah, I think he's probably going to be able to do both of those things. But I'm disappointed about the weekend. I mean, this is a team as well that has a very different car than the year prior. So much as the regulations allow, right? This is a team that adopted the 2020 Mercedes rear suspension. So the back end of the car is very different. The way they rotate the car is very different. The way that they balance the car into a corner, the way they bring the car out of a corner, all of this is very different. And then they also spent their tokens on the chassis. Mm-hmm. So they brought a very, very different car to preseason testing. Then they concluded the season with an Abu Dhabi a couple of months ago. So for me, it's a little bit nervous. It's not like, hey, we brought a leftover from last year. We just happened to have a bad weekend. It's just, we have a different car and a new driver, and we didn't put in the laps that we wanted to put in. I'm a little bit nervous for this team.
Yeah, well, I mean, Seb even said himself that he feels that he was lacking up to 100 laps of test mileage. I mean, you just do the math there. I mean, that is obviously a significant amount of laps and quite a lot of distance in testing. And it was interesting too, because Seb himself was saying that he seems pretty chill about it. I mean, he said younger Seb would be panicking right now. I'll just read this quote because I think it's interesting. Seb had to say, quote, "I'm not too preoccupied. Maybe it's the age, maybe it's the experience, but probably 10 years ago I would finally panic now. But then again, if I were to panic now, would it help? Probably not. We are just trying to do our things and use the time we now have. We still have some running, and for me, it was super, super useful, the laps on the final day. So it could be worse, it could be better, but it could be worse. So I think it's about remaining calm, doing one thing at a time, and moving forward when it's time to," end quote. So I think that there's probably a couple of things in that quote there. I think obviously it's experience, I think it's obviously age, and just realizing, I mean, hey, time is limited. They obviously, it wasn't the situation that they wanted, but they've got something. It's obviously not the amount of distance, the amount of data that they wanted, or the amount of time out on track, but they got to take what they have and see what they can make use of it. But I'm a little bit nervous for them. I'm a little bit concerned that perhaps maybe the direction that they went into was maybe a little bit too aggressive, maybe a little bit too drastic, and well, I mean, time will only tell whether or not that was the correct decision to make, and their design, and their I guess their whole theory, their ethos for this year. I mean, Ralf Schumacher, obviously a well-known name in Formula One, Michael's younger brother, and you know, also a German, obviously. You know, he was talking about his countryman Sebastian Vettel. He said he felt pity for him about the rough time he had at the Bahrain winter test, and he's a little bit nervous for Seb going into the season opener next week. So the what Ralf had to say, this is going to be a tough weekend. So obviously not a man of a lot of words, but certainly I think, you know, that's short, but very concise and to the point. It's going to be a tough weekend. And, you know, when you have a rough test like they had at Aston Martin, it's going to be tough to recover from that quickly.
Yeah. I don't know if I could ever feel pity for somebody that's won 4 driver's titles and 4 constructors titles.
Yeah, no kidding,
but,
right?
But I kind of get his point. And you know what? I unfortunately in my head a lot of times I start to project scenarios. So I'm like, oh my God, they had a bad weekend. They're gonna have a bad season by the second month of the year, by the second month of the calendar. The Hawks are gonna be all over Aston. They're gonna be all over Vettel. They're gonna be questioning whether this is the right thing. And I don't see any reason to be optimistic for the first weekend. And you know, we talked about the fact that they won't be bringing power unit upgrades at any point during the season, so that's never going to be an option. That's never going to be their escape from whatever woes they're facing. It's really just going to be, can we fix our reliability issues, and can Vettel ultimately adapt to the car to put in the sectors and link up the sectors to put in enough fast laps to get some points and win some races or at least get some podiums? And that at this point we haven't seen enough. And Again, I don't feel pity for Vettel, but I feel bad, right? Like the only driver that put in fewer laps than him was Roy Nissany at Williams. And that's because he had one session on the first day of winter testing. And Vettel is a full-time driver that had 3 sessions over 3 days, and he still only put in 117 laps. And again, it's not his fault. There were some reliability issues here, but damn, he needed that time in the car, because the next time he's going to be in the car is free practice 1, and it's going to be at the same track. So they don't get this excuse that, hey, you know what, we were at Circuit Catalonia and now we're flying off to Australia and it's a different atmosphere. Everyone's rebooted. It's the same track. It's the same experiences. It's the same temperature. It's the same humidity. So I'm a little bit nervous. Less so about the car, because I think they can bring the package together. It's just I'm a little bit nervous for how quickly Vettel can adapt to this car, given the fact that the next time he's going to be in it is going to be a timed practice session.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty radically different to what he's been used to at Ferrari for the past several years. I mean, not only is it you know, different to the car that they had last year at Racing Point, I mean, it's a whole bunch of unknowns. And just to miss out on that, you know, what he really needed in terms of mileage could be a significant handicap going into the season. But yeah. You know, it is what it is, unfortunately. But talking about Sebastian's old team, Ferrari, they keep saying that, or they're saying now that straight line speed is no longer a disadvantage. So, you know, it is quite interesting. I mean, we've speculated about this quite a bit over the past several weeks, ever since that interesting comment about, you know, the whole situation at Ferrari that kind of slipped out in that Twitch stream from Mika Salo. Anyways, I know it's become like our favorite thing to talk about, speculate about over the past 2-3 weeks or whatever it was. But Mattia Binotto, the team principal at Ferrari, said that they could see what he says a noticeable gain in straight line speed compared to last year. And Binotto had to say, quote, "We know how the engine is running at the dyno, but when you fit it on the car, what you may have to look at on the track is the speed and eventually the relative speed to the others. When we were here last year in Bahrain for the race in qualifying, we've been slow here on the straights. We didn't enter into Q3 and we were very distant from pull. Now, if I look at the data, I think at least on the speed on the straight, the speed is all right. There does not seem to be much disadvantage as it was last year. We know it's not only power, but it's a drag of the car as well, as we often said last year. But let me say it's both contributed in improving our speed on the straights. Today, we feel is not any more a disadvantage." End quote. Well, I mean, a couple of things. I mean, of course, they've gone with this high downforce model on the Ferrari over the past couple of years. I mean, the engine was obviously down on power. I mean, we've I think we've beat that one into the ground by now, speculating what those were. But it is interesting, for whatever you know, reason, that that they believe that straight line speed is back. And where they're going to factor back into the equation, I think, is, you know, it's one of the big unknowns coming into the season, because this is a team that sorely underperformed last year. I mean, they really didn't start getting back to some sort of Well, I mean, they were really uber competitive, but they really seem to have maybe have broken out of that funk by, I want to say maybe by about the time they got to the Nürburgring. I mean, the first third, or sorry, half, maybe even two thirds of the season were pretty bleak for them.
Yeah. And overshadowed. So we've talked about, and you nailed this, like we've talked to no ends about the challenges that they had from a power unit perspective. We've talked about what our belief is that what may have been driving that. And we don't need to get into that right now, but really Ferrari had two problems to solve coming into the season. One was they needed to make up that power deficit versus the rest of the field. But two, last year's car was really draggy. And this is something that Vettel talked about a lot last year. And it wasn't in kind of a critical way, but when he was asked like, hey, you know what? We have two problems to solve. One, we're way down on power. So we get crushed in the straight. And if we're on a track with any high-speed straights, we have no ability to compete. But two, the car's also super, super draggy, so we lose additional power because our aerodynamics are so far off. And I think what Matteo Binotto and Ferrari are really confident of is, A, we feel that we've solved the power issue. And let's be very clear, at winter testing last year, Ferrari's power deficit was immediate on day one. It wasn't like, hey, you know what? They look a little slow. And then it was obvious come the first race weekend. No, it was obvious from the first day of winter testing last year that something was wrong with that car. So I think they feel good. And, you know, Matteo Binotto had said during the race weekend or just this past weekend, it's like, hey, look, our straight line speed is quote unquote, not any more of a disadvantage, that they feel they've solved that as a problem. And they feel that they've made some pretty significant changes to the aerodynamics of the car to reduce that drag effect. The other good news story potentially is, and Charles Leclerc talked about this when he was interviewed this week, is he feels that the atmosphere around the team is dramatically improved. So last year, obviously, you had that crushing emotional blow of being uncompetitive for the first time in many years. And then you had the whole Sebastian Vettel story that kind of hung over the team the entire year as well, which is you have this senior driver that's not going to be with the team next year, but he's traveling with you to every single race weekend.
Yep.
So it sounds like they have a better package. They have a better power unit. And to Charles Leclerc's point, the team atmosphere is just ultimately better. Now, I don't know what it's going to look like on the track. I think they're going to be relatively reliable. I don't know if they're going to be competing for race wins, but I think they're going to be right in that mix for 3, 4, 5 if they're able to bring it all together for the season.
Yeah, it certainly is interesting too what that internal dynamic was in the team last year. What with Vettel basically, you know, riding out, it was garbage time for him, right? I mean, he was basically there just, you know, just doing his thing. I mean, he didn't publicly call them out. He wasn't lamenting or whining or complaining or anything like that. But I mean, at the very least, it must have been you know, a strange dynamic within the team and all those things, and plus with all the issues that that they were facing. But you know, just before we go into our final break here, Mark, I think that it's kind of interesting too. Just not only do you have Binotto saying that that the engine is better and that it, you know, that disadvantage they had with the straight line speed is not an issue anymore. You have Kimi Raikkonen, who's at Alfa Romeo, and they're obviously you know, a Ferrari partner team, and they have the Ferrari power unit. When they asked Kimi this week what he thought about the new Ferrari engine for this year, or the upgraded Ferrari engine, they said, "What do you think about it?" He said, "It's better."
And you know, high praise from
Kimi. Man of you know, many words. And on that note, let's just go into our final break here, and we'll start wrapping up the show on the other side. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show for one more time this week. And we've pretty much covered a pretty wide spectrum of things. And I really don't know how to finish off that previous segment than with a classic Kimi quote. I mean, you know, he really is, you know, he's kind of muted and understated, but he always seems to nail it whenever he gets it out there. Anyways, let's move away from winter testing now. Let's look at some of the other things that maybe going on the back end of Formula One in the background. I thought this was kind of a cool story, but apparently Silverstone is going to give away a whole pile of Formula One and MotoGP tickets to key workers that have helped out and done their thing throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. I thought that was pretty cool. So they're giving away, or they've allocated up to 10,000 tickets to give away for the British Grand Prix, the MotoGP race, and the Silverstone Classic, which is all scheduled for the end of July, beginning of of August. So I think this is a pretty cool way to give back to some of those people that have been out there working hard and putting themselves in harm's way over the past years. We've all been through this obviously very, very horrible time.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic gesture. I think it's meaningful. I like the fact that they posted that, you know, we could be giving away as many as 10,000 tickets. I don't think it's easy for Canadians to relate, but motorsport runs so much deeper in the fabric of the culture in the UK that this is something that's very, very meaningful, whether it's MotoGP or open wheel Formula One, that the passion for motorsports is fantastic. So I think this is great. It's good for them. And I think some really deserving frontline workers are going to the opportunity to hopefully get up and close with some of their Formula One and MotoGP heroes over the course of the next couple of months. I thought that was a great news story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is also a stark contrast to the vaccination program in the United Kingdom compared to Canada, where I think we've, I checked the stats, I think we've now vaccinated 9 people from coast to coast. So we've got our work cut out in the weeks and months ahead. And my God, I'm going to go bang my head as soon as we get off the air here this evening. But anyways, I want to talk about this one now, because we got an email that goes with this one. So the cost cap, going back to the cost cap, which we kind of led into this whole discussion about winter testing, but apparently this is coming into this whole sprint race thing, and I think we may have briefly touched on it. But of course they're pushing ahead with this experiment of the sprint races that we're going to see at over a couple of races this year to see if this can actually be a thing. And we've wondered how this might thing and or how this might turn out, of course. And one of the things that they really need to sort out is the potential of financial consequences that teams might have to face and put up with, is the extra costs associated with one of their cars being damaged in one of these sprint races, and all the all the extra costs associated with running an extra race on a race weekend. So I think this is really, really interesting. I think it's maybe something that nobody really thought about before. And of course, every time you get a car out on the track, that there's always a potential that something could happen. I mean, be it an engine blow or an accident or losing a front wing or something like that. And of course, nothing that goes on to or nothing is cheap in Formula One. Now, all those bits that go on the car are extremely, extremely expensive. So I think this is an interesting discussion to have.
Yeah, it's something I had failed to really consider as well. And I think to compound the issue is we already have a 23 race calendar, and potentially we're going to add 4 more competitive events to that mix. Like, yeah, it's a really, really interesting thought, and certainly not one that I had considered ultimately. But I'm going to be curious to see how the sport reconciles this. And if the sprint races happen and they're successful, I'm really curious to see how they're integrated into the calendar in subsequent seasons and the frequency with which they're mixed. Is this something that Formula One hopes to introduce to every race weekend, or to the point that we talked about a couple of weeks ago? Could these be majors where you see it 3 or 4 times a year at premium events? I'm very, very curious. I don't have any answers, but I'm very, very curious. But to your earlier point as well, like when we've been talking excitedly about the prospect of sprint race weekends, never once have I talked about the consequences to the teams from a financial resource availability perspective. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's something that completely, I think, flew underneath the radar. Neither of us picked up on it. But, it's interesting too. We had an interesting email I'm going to lead into it. I mean, this is more about the format of the whole sprint race thing, rather than these unexpected costs and financial consequences that might arise. So this is from Matthew Kroll, weighing in from Madison, Wisconsin. He says, "Hey guys, love the podcast. I like the sprint race idea, but it seems that something has been overlooked. I'm involved in asphalt circle track racing, and the local tracks will use a set invert for the feature. We see this in dirt racing as well. There have been discussions of reverse grids in Formula One, but I haven't heard anyone mention a top 6 or a top 10 invert. I think this could create some additional strategy. I don't want to see a full reverse grid, but a 6 to 10 car invert for the sprint race for the Grand Prix could work. Curious on your thoughts." You know, I think it's interesting. I think that is a fascinating idea. I mean, we've talked about it, quite a few times, and both of us are completely 100% against the whole 100% flip to reverse grid. But I think this is an interesting concept that Matt's touched on here, that maybe flipping the top six or perhaps the top 10 cars, you know, if that's something that that works in other races, other forms of racing, that I think it's a fascinating that perhaps you could kind of throw that wrench in there. I mean, obviously you're going to have some cars that flip the top 10. I mean, the 10th car is theoretically slower than the first car, and could really shake things up quite a bit. I mean, of course you run the risk of maybe something making something too complicated, but I think there's something in this.
Yeah. First of all, thank you, Matthew, for the email. Much appreciated. From Madison, Wisconsin. Shout out Milwaukee Bucks, Milwaukee Brewers, and the Green Bay Packers. I'm sure you're a big sports fan. It's also kind of curious where we're finding these Formula One fans pop up, right? Like you wouldn't normally kind of associate Wisconsin or Illinois or Minnesota with open wheel racing fans, maybe a little bit of IndyCar, but it also shows the reach that the sport's starting to have. Yeah. And hopefully for the sake of, for Matt, we get Formula One back in Indianapolis one day, because that's a road trip that I think is doable, as opposed to Austin from Wisconsin. But again, thank you so much for the email. And I think that's a really great idea. I also like to see that this is an individual and he kind of speaks to his past experience with asphalt circle tracks and local dirt tracks. But that's an interesting concept. And I think it's something I'd have to see simulated to get a sense of how it could translate in the real world. But I think it's a really, really cool idea. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to, talking about the some of the demographics for the listeners of this show, I mean, we've never targeted geographically or any specific age group or anything like that. But over 50% of our listeners to the podcast are from the USA. And then you have Canada, the UK, Australia.
Really?
Yeah. But, the amount that the base of our listeners are in the USA is absolutely amazing. I mean, we all know how crazy Americans are about cars, are about sports, but the fact that just sort of organically from, this massive base of American listeners has kind of grown up on its own was really quite surprising. And it's pretty cool. And, I think more to the point, it really demonstrates, at least in the small market share that we have on the show here, that, I mean, there is a definite interest in Formula One in the United States. And I mean, obviously that's why Liberty's looking at this race in Miami. And we've heard possibly of maybe a third race, right? Maybe Long Beach, New York, whatever it might be, or even go back to Indy if that could ever be an option again. I mean, that is something that, definitely, they need to, to explore and try to, to grow more. Because like I said, I mean, I won't be 100% convinced that Formula One is really a thing in the United States and Canada until I walk into my 7-Eleven and a life-size cardboard cutout of Lewis is trying to sell me a Diet Pepsi or Twinkies or whatever it might be, or a case of Miller Lite. Yeah, then I'll know that that Formula One really is a thing. But I mean, there's definite interest in the sport.
So 2 points on that. First, one, it's now clear to me why you made me sign a contract forcing me not to talk about U.S. politics on the air. So now I understand why I had to sign that contract in blood. But two, now I feel like a bit of a chump too, because I always talk about North American sports, of which I'm a diehard fan, in the most condescending way, as if all of our listeners are European and they have no idea what the NBA is, whereas most of our listeners probably have an intimate knowledge of the collective bargaining agreement and the mid-level exception in the NBA. Here I am talking about the
You've been
NBA
talking
the
down to
the
these
basketball.
People. You've been talking down to our audience. They probably know it as good as or better than either of us do, but no, it's pretty cool to see where the most of the listeners are. I haven't really dived into it in a detail to see if there's one sort of geographic hotspot in the country where people are listening more, but certainly it's a pretty cool thing to see. All right, I just want to go on to the last couple of stories that I'd picked out to look at this week. One of them is, and I know this is one that we obviously have some pretty mixed feelings about, is this this night race that's going to take place in Saudi Arabia next year for the obvious human rights issues that they, you know, that that are associated with the country. But you know, this story is out there. They've revealed what you know, what the layout of the track is going to be in Jeddah. It's a street circuit, and you know, they're boasting you know, speeds which they're anticipating up to about 250 kilometers an hour, which is, it's also going to be the longest and the fastest street calendar on, or street circuit on the calendar for next year. I mean, it looks really interesting, but you know, just in general, I've got some, you know, I've got a lot of mixed conflicting emotions about this one. And I should add also that it's going to be 6.175 kilometers long. That's the track there. Second longest after Spa on the circuit for next year.
It's funny. I woke up this morning, and as I think a lot of our listeners probably do, the first thing I do is like bumble around, grab my phone, open Instagram, and start flipping through. Yeah, exactly. Because that's where I get so much of my news. And this was one of the first things that popped up, was a bunch of renderings of the Jeddah track. And the first thing I did was less so look at the images, but more look at the comments. And it's the same thing that I see every single time Formula One posts something about Jeddah, which is every single response is just blasting Formula One for this decision. Just for the exact reason that you spoke to, the human rights piece. Like, it's going to be very difficult, I think, for Formula One to, as we get closer to this race, continue to promote it in the same sense. Like, you know what? I think a lot of people that are outside of that region kind of clump it all together, that it's all the same. But I think from country to country in that region, society and cultural and human rights and women's rights are fundamentally different. And in the United Arab Emirates, which is where Abu Dhabi is worlds ahead of Saudi Arabia in terms of being progressive and open and all those different types of things. And Qatar is more, and Bahrain is more, but Saudi is just, the kingdom is just in a different world. And I'm still very uncomfortable with this. And you hear that whole comment about sport washing, which is like, hey, let's throw a sport there. And you know what? They're big league now, and we can turn a blind eye to all of these other kind of pieces. It's just like, I'm so happy with some of the great things that the United Arab Emirates has done over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And the fact that that society continues to be progressive relative to most of its neighbors. I haven't seen the same efforts in Saudi. I really haven't. And I feel like, in a sense, that they're being rewarded with this race, and we all know why it's there, and it's purely a cash transaction, and it's purely because of the Aramco tie-up as a core sponsor of the sport. But I look at this region, and I'm like, the United Arab Emirates has done so many great things, and they've built a great track. And Saudi, So I'm going to leave it at that.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add to that. But you mentioned Qatar. My good friend Simon Fudge, you know, is a longtime soccer journalist. You know, he's worked for Vancouver Whitecaps. He's worked for Sky Sports, FIFA. Just literally touched down in Qatar earlier today for starting a 2-year stint involved with the media side for the World Cup. So that's shout out to my buddy Simon. We're going to miss you, buddy. So maybe if COVID ever gets we can put it behind us sooner. Maybe there's an opportunity to go visit him down there. But finally, getting to our last story of the show tonight, Jos Capito, the CEO of Williams, still trying to get these names right with the new regime at Williams. You know, you're used to saying Sir Frank or Claire Williams, and all these names that you've associated with them over the years. Anyways, Jos was saying, you're just talking about George Russell and the potential that possibility at least that he could go to Williams, or sorry, not to Williams, but Mercedes next year. In an interview with Formel1.de, or Formel1.de or .de. I'm trying to mix German and English here, and it's getting late, not doing too well. Anyways, Jos had to say, quote, "If a driver gets an offer from Mercedes in the current situation, there are very few alternatives." And that's it. Quote, end quote. And they really wouldn't have any choices. I mean, who would they really to say that they wouldn't want him to go or try and keep him? I mean, that would be the, that would be the dream move. And it would obviously put Williams in a bit of a tough spot. I mean, but I think that, and as we've talked about, quite a few times, or quite a number of times, that George is really getting to, a very crucial point in his young career. And if that opportunity to go to Mercedes, if should one of those race seats open up for 2022, you'd have to take it. You'd absolutely have to take it. And no disrespect to Williams, but you guys would be out of luck.
There's a reason why Williams brought three drivers to winter testing, right? Like they have to strategically be anticipating that this could happen. Maybe probably not in season, but next season, and they need to start getting another driver comfortable in that car. And Nissany also potentially brings a big chunk of cash with him, so I think Williams would be very happy to have two largely paid drivers. But yeah, you're right. There's no question. And for all intents and purposes, he's there on loan anyways. This isn't a driver that came through the Williams Academy. This is a Mercedes driver that's in a Williams car because they run a Mercedes power unit and because Mercedes didn't have a seat for him. I shouldn't say he belongs to him. Nobody belongs to anybody else, but he's effectively a Mercedes driver, and that's where he's ultimately going to end up.
Yeah, I mean, it has to happen at some point, or else, you know, as I think we talked about a couple of weeks ago, then he's going to become like the 2021 version of Esteban Ocon, you know, with this great tie up to Mercedes that ultimately becomes like an anchor and a handcuff, and then it limits you in some of the options that you have within Formula One. And I think as very much as we're watching George Russell, I think it'll be interesting to see what Esteban Ocon does this year, because quite honestly, I thought last year, in his first year back in Formula One after sitting out in 2019, I thought, he looked a little bit rusty. I mean, there were a little bit of flashes. And I mean, in his first go round with Racing Point or Force India, I guess it was Racing Point by the time he was in there. I mean, there were certainly some flashes that this was a very talented young driver. So, sitting out and missing a year that early in your career, I mean, at any point in your career isn't great. But I think especially when you're a young driver like that, you lose a lot of momentum sitting in the garage watching a monitor with the headset on for an entire year.
69 minutes until Drive to Survive drops. 69 minutes.
There you go. We'll finish wrapping this one up, and while all the this is uploading and everything's processing, there we go. We can sit down and download and start streaming the first episode. So there you go. Happy Friday, everyone. Happy start of the season, basically, because can you believe it, Mark? Like we said off the top of the show, that by the time we come back this time next week, it's full on season preview, full on race preview. It's really, really exciting. And on that note, I've got nothing else to add for tonight.
Okay, we're out of here.
We're out of here, absolutely. Well, thank you, everybody, for downloading, listening to the show, watching and tuning in on YouTube. If you want to get in touch, by all means, please do so. Drop us an email at scuderiaf1pod@gmail.com. We're on Twitter at scuderiaf1pod. And if you want to support us and you want to help the show up, by all means, we'd very much appreciate that. And the easiest and quickest way to do that is hop onto Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast and leave a 5-star rating review for your favorite podcast. And when you're done giving that to them, come on over and give us a nice review as well. We'd appreciate it. And especially, you can give us a shout out to our self-defeated sense of humor. And on that note, that's it. That's a wrap. Enjoy the show. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy season 3 of Drive to Survive. And we'll talk to you guys this time next week. Bye for now.